Hello, I'm Andy Burnham. Welcome to Sparks. This week, as vinyl records are dropped by high street shops, can the format survive? Can we learn from what happened to the 78? And how about copying them to CD with the latest recording technology? Philips has delayed the launch of its DCC. What will this mean? And the WARC meet to thrash out spectrum allocation for new broadcasting technologies such as digital audio broadcasting, digital car phones, and high-definition television. Hold jocks on the telephone. A backpack fridge for carrying vaccines. Ovaltinis in the IEE. Public address in the Channel Tunnel. And of course your letters. That's all on Sparks this week from Radiofax. 6205 12255 and now 3910. Electronics World News, WARC are taking on spectrum issues by Brian Robinson and Simon Lowe. A wide range of spectrum allocation issues will be negotiated in Torremolinos in Spain from February the 3rd at the largest meeting of the World Radio Administrative Conference since 1979. The commercial launch of many new technologies for the next decade and beyond will be affected by the outcome of WARC 92, a huge undertaking that will last about 1 month. The emergence of Europe, technologically and politically, will give WARC 92 a much different look than such previous meetings organised by the International Telecommunications Union, the ITU. "We've never seen Europe so unified," said Michael Fitch, a senior policy advisor in the United States Department's Bureau of Internal Communications and Information Policy. "It's an incredibly powerful bloc." The WARC meeting has treaty status, but any one of the more than 150 countries that participates always has the option to abstain, in effect, and pursue its own strategy. Europe is still likely to go its own way with digital audio broadcasting, using terrestrial delivery, for example, if no common global allocation is agreed upon, said Phil Laven, chief engineer at the R&D labs of the BBC. Making global frequency allocations for satellite-based services and technologies will be a major focal point of WARC 92, because finding common ground here will be the most important. Crucial to United States' ambitions at WARC 92 will be its proposals on mobile satellite services. To meet growing needs using geostationary orbit satellites, the United States is proposing the reallocation of land mobile satellite and marine mobile satellite services to multi-purpose allocations. It's also proposing low Earth orbiting satellites, or LEOs, within the MSS proposal to cover such systems such as the Iridium project planned by Motorola. Japan is interested in the opportunities presented by wide RF band high-definition television. "Japan will propose using 25 gigahertz for the service," said Taku Kiyazu, Deputy Director General of the Science and Technical Research Laboratories at the Japan Broadcasting Corporation. "Japan's Muse High Vision and Europe's HD Max systems are currently designed to use band compression techniques in a channel of 27 or 24 megahertz bandwidth in the 2 gigahertz band. But Nishiwaza said this bandwidth is just not sufficient for transmitting HDTV signals that are virtually transparent to the HDTV studio production system, resulting in little or no reduction in the quality delivered to viewers. Reallocating spectrum for any services already existing in domestic markets will be a stumbling block in negotiations. A sore point in Japan will be new proposals, perhaps for DAB or mobile satellite communications, for the 1.5 GHz band. There's no way Japan can give up this band for other new satellite services, said MPT's Kiyazu. "Absolutely no," is the message we've been delivering to the rest of the world. With so much of the WARC 92 agenda expected to be weighed down in such controversy, many of the specifics may have to be sorted out in later meetings. One factor making the outcome of WARC 92 unpredictable is the disintegration of the former Soviet Union. New republics will be free to make their own decisions, and third world countries, wary of being usurped by the world's technology leaders, will have their own agenda too. That report in Electronics World News. hello to Patrick Cody, writing from Portroe, County Tipperary, in Ireland. I enjoy listening to your programmes, especially programmes on radio and communications. I've been a shortwave listener for a long number of years and wish your station every success. There's a report, thanks for that, and also a nice postcard from Nenar, which is in Tipperary. Yes, the chief town of North Tipperary. He sends best wishes on that. Thanks very much, Patrick Cody. So now the first of four reports this week on the possible demise of the vinyl LP.
The loneliness of the long-playing record listeners. Sarah Lonsdale in The Observer. The BBC is developing a solar-powered CD player, a contingency plan so Desert Island Discs castaways will not be deprived of music if vinyl records disappear and the statutory wind-up gramophone supplied with the works of Shakespeare and the Bible becomes redundant. The historical wind-up gramophone may have to give way to some kind of solar-powered alternative, said a Radio 4 spokesman. This unhappy day will never dawn if the analogue addicts have their way. They are a small guerrilla force of hi-fi buffs, fighting what they see as the threat to consumer choice and quality music recording by the shiny silver digital imposter. However, in the wake of Boots, Woolworths and WH Smith announcing their intention to stop stocking vinyl LPs, and Britain's biggest music retailer, Our Price, saying that the vinyl LP will eventually all but disappear, hopes for saving this century's most popular form of entertainment appear doomed. The Addicts campaign is reminiscent of efforts to save the shellac 78 RPM in the 1950s and the waxed cylinders at the end of the 19th century, says music historian Dimitri Corriton. The vinyl supporters say there is one major difference. Sound quality on vinyl is better than on CD. Analog Addicts are predominantly male, get perilously close to being boring when talking at length on their favourite subject, and will travel miles after a sighting of a limited edition Blue Note jazz recording or a discontinued Bitstream D2A conversion. They believe the CD revolution was a manufacturer's plot to con the public into buying the new inferior product. All froth and no soul. The plot has certainly worked. British consumers spent £250 million on vinyl LPs in 1985 and £33 million on CDs. By 1990, the figures were £141 million for LPs and £500 million for CDs. LPs now only account for 8% of the British album market, although, curiously, less than 30% of the population own a CD player, and more than 80% own a turntable. In America, the changeover to CD was definitely engineered, with record manufacturers offering retailers financial incentives to stock CDs. But in this country, the public simply appears to have chosen CDs over vinyl, says Dimitri Corriton, who, despite his 4,000-strong vinyl collection, to which he is deeply attached, is a compact disc convert. Analog Addicts believe the digital method of recording compact discs is vastly inferior to the analog method of recording on vinyl. The vinyl sound is richer and more faithful to the original, they say. They have many allies, including Radio 1 DJs and Professor Jack Dinsdale, the applied physicist who designs turntables. Several times a year, Dinsdale, who is a professor of mechatronics at Dundee University, demonstrates recordings on vinyl and CD and asks the audience which sounds better. 9 times out of 10, they choose the vinyl, he said. I once had a team of engineers from Philips do the test, and to their surprise, they all chose vinyl. Veteran Radio 1 DJ John Peel, in defence of vinyl, said, What about surface noise? I hear you whine. Listen, mate, life has surface noise, and I like it. Peel's colleague, Mark Goodyear, says vinyl singles are much cheaper to produce, and there is a danger that new bands will be put off trying to break into the recorded music market by the prohibitive cost of producing samples. We'll just end up like America with bland corporate rock, he says. Other vinyl lovers mourn the loss of the 12-inch album cover, an art form since pop artist Peter Blake designed the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band cover in 1967. Then there have been the picture discs, the coloured discs, the see-through vinyl, and the rare scratched-in messages around the inside ring in limited editions. These idiosyncrasies have disappeared under the record company's endless quest for profit margins, say vinyl's defenders. The Office of Fair Trading is investigating the pricing of CDs, which retail at about £11, but cost less than £1 to manufacture. It will publish its report later this year. Jeremy Silver, spokesman for the British phonographic industry, believes vinyl's death is a foregone conclusion, and a future is virtually upon us of vinyl collectors meeting in damp church halls, desperately trying to chase some long-since-deleted album. However, he would be wise to look at the Dutch experience. Holland, the home of Philips, took quickly to CD players. Last year, 70% of the population owned a CD player, and there was a grand announcement that as from January this year, no more vinyl would be pressed in the country. But vinyl lovers objected to being forced to travel to Germany and Belgium to buy their records. Small specialist vinyl shops have begun to flourish. Vinyl continues to be pressed, and turntable sales have rocketed in the past 12 months, say turntable manufacturers Lynn Products. They are confident they will be selling turntables well into the next millennium. The analog addicts have bitten back. Sarah Lonsdale, writing about people who prefer a bit of distortion and compression, in The Observer.
And we last week showed how you can get approaching 20-bit quality off 16-bit CDs, so maybe that complaint won't be so valid in the next few years. And, comment on WH Smith's LP figures, the actual choice in WH Smith's, if you looked recently, has been so appalling for LPs that it's not surprising they're not selling very many of them. Benny Green, also in the same issue of The Observer, the jazz DJ and journalist, mourns the passing of the LP record after only 43 years, but suspects that the CD usurper will itself be overtaken. That faint whirring sound you can hear is Dr. Peter Goldmark turning in his grave. 43 years ago, the doctor, an employee of the Columbia Record Company, released a new invention, the long-playing record. At a stroke, it swept away hand-winding gramophones, steel needles, and most significant of all, performances limited to a duration of 3.5 minutes. The effect on concert music was galvanic. Most popular performers were able to say all they had to say in around 3 minutes, but before Dr. Goldmark, the only way to enjoy a classical work whenever you pleased was to listen to it piecemeal, with an interval every 3 minutes. It comes back to me that a friend of my teens, with an obsessive regard for Debussy, went around with a box containing the 12 sides comprising Nuages. Dr. Goldmark finished all that. From now on, you could enjoy up to 30 minutes music without having to adjust the machine. There were purists who received the newfangled device with a blend of outrage and indifference, if such a blend is possible. They had invested too much emotional capital acquiring the arcana of the recording business. Those prescient 78s of Bic Spiderbeck and Jelly Roll Morton, Ruth Etting and Annette Hanshaw. Now it seemed they could buy their records 16 or 20 at a time. It took all the romance out of it. No more burrowing through endless record racks in the hope of finding the pressing. What Dr. Goldmark had done was to flood the market to banish antiquarianism. But opposition soon crumbled. Even the bigots admitted that the sound reproduction was better, and though the long player, by no means indestructible, was less likely to shatter if it fell on the floor. And it was certainly true that all sorts of obscure performances were becoming accessible. It was true also that the new album saved vast amounts of shelf space. Once the long player established itself, the speed with which the 78 became extinct was astonishing. Now you see it, now you don't. The recording companies, ruthlessly pragmatic as always, simply ditched the old ways for the new. Of course, in that case, a few years ago, you just needed to buy a new stylus in many cases to play the new records, so there wasn't the great expense of new equipment. So before you pull down the old shelves and put up new ones to accommodate your growing army of CDs, I should wait a while, just in case yet another revolution is around the corner, and spare a thought for poor old Dr. Goldmark, whose surefire copper-bottomed lease on immortality ran out after only about 43 years. Benny Green in The Observer. And hello to W. Ashcroft, who says, I received my Sparks competition prize and am very grateful. The signal on 6205 is excellent on my Selena B215 8-band radio with its built-in telescopic aerial. I enjoy the archive programs and the Sparks program, but I don't like the country music program. He asks, when are we going to start live broadcasts? Well, we'd love to. But to do that, we need to have transmitters in Britain, and to do that, we need a license. So, I repeat the request that if you would write to your MP asking that HF independent broadcasting be looked at more seriously, because the Radio Authority currently has no authority to do anything with HF, and it's all down to the BBC. The Radio Authority themselves seem quite keen to be given this power. However, the parts of the government that license are not so keen, so more lobbying could well help us out. And if you send a copy of the letter you write to us, we'll read it out and also read out the reply you get. See if it's another stock reply like one I'll read later on in the programme. If you write us a letter, I guarantee to say hello to you on the air. And if you'd like to send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1, you can receive our station card, along with technical information and an artist's impression of the transmitter site. The address? Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG.
Down the alleyway, looking for a new friend. A man in wants $11 bills. He
In The Engineer, vaccines make it up the mountain. Medical teams in Nepal should soon be able to carry refrigerated vaccines to remote villages following the invention of a fridge backpack weighing just 22 kilograms when full that runs on a drop of kerosene. The problem with existing methods of refrigeration is that they require big blocks of ice for vaccine transport. A student from Cranfield Institute of Technology, Liam Nagel, has come up with a solution. He's taken a standard Electrolux vapor absorption fridge and adapted it for use with kerosene, a fuel widely available in Nepal. The novelty in Nagel's fridge is its kerosene burner. He chose to use a simple wick burner, but despite modifying the wick's shape, he found too much soot was produced, leading to flue blockage. He solved this problem by boring a hole through the middle of the wick into the kerosene vessel. A second hole, with adjustable aperture, was made through the side of the kerosene container just below the wick. Once the wick has been lit and the unit warmed up, the kerosene begins to vaporize before igniting. The aperture is then opened and air is drawn in, mixing with the kerosene vapor and making the fuel burn more efficiently. When the mix is right, no soot is produced, says Nagel. Heat produced by the burner is used to evaporate and condense a solution of ammonia and water, which in turn draws heat from the fridge space. Nagel says that by burning 10 grams of kerosene for an hour, the fridge becomes cool enough to store the vaccine at temperatures between 0 and 8 Celsius. If the kerosene supply runs out, the fridge is claimed to keep the vaccine cool for up to 3 days. Cranfield is now looking for a manufacturer to commercialize the backpack so that children in Nepalese villages can be vaccinated by Save the Children Fund aid workers. Well, our very own Holly is on her way back from Nepal, so no doubt we'll get to have a talk to her in the next few weeks. I'll have to show her that, because she'll probably be interested. You're listening to Sparks on Radio Fax, 6205 12255 and 3910 for the winter to the United Kingdom. Fresh programmes start on Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays and Sundays. So, hello to Michael Tucci in Massachusetts in the United States. And I was mentioning a few minutes ago about stock replies from the Home Office. Well, enclosed is the response I received from my letter to Kenneth Baker, Michael writes, on your station's behalf. I hope it helps. Best of luck in the future. I continue to listen when broadcasting conditions are good. Well, if he wrote to Kenneth Baker all the way from America, I'm sure you can. However, it'll be interesting to see if you get the same reply. This is the same as was sent to John Hanneman, MP, and the same reply. Dear Mr. Tucci, thank you for your letter of the 3rd of October. I'm sorry you have not had an earlier reply. You asked whether Radio Fax could be given a broadcasting licence. Perhaps I should explain first, by way of background, that until the beginning of this year, the only organisations licensed to broadcast programmes for general reception were the BBC and the IBA. However, the Broadcasting Act of 1990 introduced a new framework in which the Radio Authority took over responsibility for licensing all independent, that is non-BBC, radio services and regulating their activities under a lighter regime. This should facilitate a major expansion of radio services over the next few years, with independent radio services competing with the BBC at the national level for the first time, and with many new local services addressing the tastes and interests of listeners more closely than was possible under the previous arrangements. The Radio Authority clearly cannot license stations in every area or for every community at once. They are moving as quickly as possible within the resources available and hope to license about 30 new stations each year. National radio licences are awarded by a process involving competitive tender, while the key to winning a local radio licence is to offer a service which would enhance the range of listening choice in the area concerned. There is therefore no reason in principle why Radio Fax should not put in a bid for one of the national radio licences or apply for a local licence when advertised. I understand, however, that Radio Fax would wish to broadcast on shortwave. At present, the radio authority does not have access to any shortwave frequencies. This is primarily due to two reasons. Bad grammar there. Firstly, the historical position, which I have outlined, has meant that only the BBC has been permitted to use shortwave frequencies in this country for broadcasting its world service. Secondly, since shortwave transmissions have the characteristic of travelling great distances, they have enormous potential to cause interference, and very careful planning has been necessary to ensure adequate reception for existing services within the band, which is highly congested. In the circumstances, it could be difficult to accommodate new services on shortwave, and the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, which, in funding the BBC's World Service, currently has the major interest in the use of shortwave, may in any case first wish to examine the wider implications of any proposal to extend the use of this waveband. Ending in gobbledygook there is the reply from R.L. Macy from the Broadcasting Department of the Home Office. It all sounds rather silly when we're only really talking about using the power of one radio amateur from the United States. However, that's the British government, so your letter to them would be very much appreciated, and we'll see if we get some more replies like that, or whether they can be bothered to write a new reply.
Thank you.
Some particularly crackly records today, perhaps illustrating the problem with LPs.
Nobody seems to question now that the LP will become extinct. Woman's Hour did a piece on the subject, following the announcement that WH Smith would stop stocking LPs.
It's the latest nail in the coffin of the vinyl record, which now makes up only 8% of music sales. The compact disc, introduced less than 10 years ago, is now the market leader. But music fans are split between those who embrace the new technology for its convenience and clean sounds, and others who feel LPs are still not only the best sounding, but the best looking format for music. The broadcaster and musicologist Lucy Duran has no doubt where she stands.
I'm desperately mourning the passing of the LP. I think there's no other medium like it. And a CD for me is just completely characterless. It sits on a shelf like a sort of a bunch of clinical specimens.
Whenever I go to anyone's house, you know, I get on the kneel down the floor, start flipping through, you know, people's albums, and somehow CDs all look sort of very bland. They call them jewel cases for some reason. It's plastic boxes. I'll miss the artwork that you got and the information that was available on sleeves of vinyl albums. It's like having a hardback book, you know, as distinct from a paperback.
CD is still a phrase that you would use in the same way that you would use coffee table, you know, style mag. It's one of those things that's sort of part of grown up living, you know, your Elton John compilation.
People who liked Eric Clapton and Phil Collins and Mike and the Mechanics, those kind of maybe 30-something type people who could afford to buy the more expensive CD format, you know, they were the ones that perpetuated the CD sales, really. But, you know, if vinyl's not going to be made available to people, then younger people will have to buy CDs. And so, consequently, that weird image that a CD has got, i.e. it's a bit stuffy and a bit posy, will probably disappear. You know, a lot of people are really mourning the fact that with the LP, you know, you're going to lose a lot of artwork and really nice pictures and that sort of thing. But with CDs, you know, because they can have a little booklet to fit inside a CD, and, you know, it has great cover notes on it, and it means that the star involved has much more opportunity to thank lots of people. And I always like reading those little messages from pop stars to their mates when they say, thanks for your help, you know, thanks for cooking the dinners. And also, you get more pictures with a CD, usually, because there's more pages to the booklet, so they have to have more artwork and more pictures to make it look nicer.
A piece of 12-inch vinyl, an LP, it conjures up such pictures for me. I can almost see the music jumping off the vinyl at me. I like the look of it on the shelf. I like the bigness, the size of the covers, and they're one of the great art products of this century, album covers.
The record industry in its format has been so stagnant for so long. And if you think about it, vinyl is just an incredible dinosaur. You know, it's easy to scratch, they warp easily, you know. So it's time to say goodbye to them, really. And collecting records is a bit of a boyish thing, in a way. And I think perhaps women will find it easier to accept CDs, because they probably weren't such avid record collectors. Do you know, I don't think they'll be getting their Yes LPs out in 20 years' time and saying, look at this, what an item, you know, it's probably worth £200. They'll be saying, oh, look at all those New Kids on the Block LPs, why did I ever keep them?
The onward march of the CD. The voices you heard were the music journalists Alex Caddis and Laura Lee Davis, the broadcasters Annie Nightingale and Lucy Duran, and Jeremy Silver of the British Phonographic Industry.
Woman's Hour on BBC Radio 4.
So women prefer CDs, do they? Not something I've ever come across. A comment about records scratching easily. I used to work for Radio HMV in London, and they used to have many CDs going through their hands, and they used to be rather paranoid about them getting dusty or something. They had one of these little rotary CD cleaners like you can buy in the record shops, and every single time they played every single CD, they used to run it through this little windy CD cleaner. And what used to happen is the CDs actually got scratched and they caused errors and they didn't work. And of course, guess who they took it out on? Well, yes, the CDs failed on me, and what fun I had. But anyway, looking at the CDs, there were thousands and thousands of tiny circular scratches etched into them. So CDs are far from immortal, And a warning not to clean your CDs too much. Roland Burkhard writes from Solothurn in Switzerland. Your signals arrived here. We're very well in Switzerland. I will tune into your programmes from time to time. Do you transmit every day or only on weekends? Well, we're on every day, and there's some new programmes to listen out for, currently on Wednesdays and Fridays. Today it's Sparks, our weekly programme of media, scientific and technical news. And the occasional silly record.
Tunnel Vision. The Channel Tunnel project has been in the public eye for the past 10 years, despite the best efforts of its operators. Now the connection to France has been made, technical equipment is being installed, including the public address system. Kathleen White, in Sound Communication Systems, investigates the progress so far. 2 years shy of completion, the Channel Tunnel project has weathered a series of storms concerning budget overruns, personality conflicts, and fears over safety, all the time attended by a critical and, in some cases, derisive press. But despite the pessimism, progress has been impressive. The two running tunnels and the service tunnel are complete, all 50 kilometres long, and bored, for the most part, through a layer of chalk marl 25 to 45 metres beneath the seabed. Construction of terminal buildings and interchanges is proceeding apace. Work is actually running ahead of schedule. With French and British air quietly mingling beneath the seabed, the Channel Tunnel is no longer a fantasy, but a fait accompli. For better or worse, the UK now has a land link to the continent. The emphasis has now switched from digging to operational matters: transportation, ventilation, telecommunications. At this juncture, the tunnel's public address system is midway to completion. The PA system going into the tunnel is not intended for the usual sorts of routine announcements along the lines of the 9:45 to Coquelle has been cancelled. It will serve as the emergency communications system, also known as the voice evacuation system, also known as the non-routine use PA network. There's no suitable euphemism that's been found to describe the PA's function. And that gives a hint that there might be some sensitivity about safety issues. Not that one might suspect this from reading the glossy tunnel press literature, which is positively chock-a-block with cheerful reports proclaiming safety as a major, if not dominant, issue affecting the design of everything that has gone down there. It would be naive to assume that Eurotunnel, the developer and operator of the tunnel, and its building contractor, Transmanche Link, might not be just a bit touchy about safety issues. One does not need an overactive imagination to see that the tunnel will be vulnerable to disasters, both natural and unnatural. It's also true that the project has had its share of bad press, and the developers would dearly like to avoid more. From experience researching this story, they will have to try a bit harder. Eurotunnel's response to inquiries was patronising, arrogant, and liberally sprinkled with that well-known phrase, "We'll get back to you on that," a guaranteed method of fueling suspicions that there's something to hide, though the less cynical might merely bemoan falling standards among press officers. It is particularly ironic that while Eurotunnel appears reluctant to discuss tunnel safety, perhaps for fear of unduly alarming the public, who, after all, must use the tunnel if its operators are to make any money, TML and its contractors are busy assuming the worst possible scenarios and building equipment and systems to cope. Cause celebre, one would have thought. The contract to build the public address system in the Channel Tunnel is worth nearly £2 billion. And forms just one part of a larger telecommunications contract valued in excess of £20 million. Rakel Milgo Limited won the contract in a competitive tender that attracted bids from several large international telecoms companies. Because the contract was so complicated, Rakel Milgo gathered together several specialist companies to work on the bid from the outset. Among these were the French firms GTIE and SAT, with expertise in systems installation and fibre optics respectively, Manchester-based Costain Telecommunications and Systems provided overall project management and design for the PA and telephone systems in the tunnel. One of several subcontractors is Whitley Electronics of Mansfield, which designed, manufactured, and commissioned the PA system. As the design authority for this setup, CTSL has a responsibility for the Folkestone and Coquelles terminals and 72 individual systems within the service tunnel between these two points. Whitley got the entire PA package, including design, manufacture, and commissioning, though installation will be done by GTIE. In the hierarchical world of tunnel contracts, the chain goes back through Whitley to CTSL to Rakel Milgo to TML, and finally to Eurotunnel. Beneath Whitley, there are other subcontractors. Loudspeakers are being supplied by DNH, while acoustic surveys and design are being carried out by Sandy Brown Associates. In terms of equipment, the PA system comprises approximately 5,000 loudspeakers, 142 200-watt amplifiers, as part of the subsystem within the tunnel's electrical equipment rooms, and about 300 local microphone units which will be installed in the cross passages. Additionally, the Folkestone and Kakel terminal areas contain rack subsystems which call for a further 100 200 watt amplifiers. Roughly 2,000 loudspeakers will be distributed at both terminals, providing coverage for toll booths, vehicle holding areas, customs and loading platforms. In the tunnel, around 3,000 loudspeakers will be distributed in the 140 plus pairs of cross passages that run between the two train tunnels and the service tunnel. Loudspeaker coverage in the service tunnel will run in 100 metre lengths, 50 metres either side of a cross passage. About 30% of the overall service tunnel will have speaker coverage. The microphones in each cross passage are for train guards to relay instructions via loudspeakers, with electrical equipment rooms positioned alongside every other cross passage pair. There is no PA in the two running tunnels. Although these have walkways, in an emergency, passengers would be guided through the cross passages into the service tunnel. In any event, the shuttle trains have their own PA systems, with that contract being handled by the French firm Morse Technophone. All PA system equipment is connected via fibre optic cable to IPIS, Integrated Passenger Information System, Whitley's command and control digital multiplexer, which itself integrates into Rakel Milgo's fibre optic data transmission network. IPIS takes all information back to control panels at four control centres. Each terminal has two, a road control centre and a rail control centre. Power for the system is via minus 50 volts telecommunications supplies. If the Channel Tunnel operates as reliably and safely as Eurotunnel intends, this is one PA system that will see little use.
Now continuing our look at the Channel Tunnel emergency PA system.
It is intended for non-routine operation only, in the event of breakdowns or emergencies in the tunnels and terminal areas. Whitley Electronics faced a number of unusual conditions in designing the system. The service tunnel offered a highly reverberant and potentially very noisy environment, while the terminal areas needing coverage were outdoors and subject to noise pollution imitations, particularly at the Folkestone end. In the service tunnel, the PA has had to jostle for room with all the other equipment, power cables, lighting and radio antenna, among other items. Every 375 metres, a pair of cross passages from the two running tunnels connect with the service tunnel. Normally, the doors from the train tunnels into the cross passages remain shut. There are separate piston relief ducts running between the train tunnels about every 250 metres that equalise air pressure. To further complicate matters, the service tunnel does not always run in parallel to the two running tunnels. Things are actually a bit more three-dimensional down there than one imagines. At the terminal ends, the service tunnel crosses under one of the running tunnels to emerge to the side of the two running tunnels. In addition, at two points about a third of the distance from the terminals, the running tunnels converge to run alongside each other, allowing trains to cross over from north to south. At these points, the service tunnel continues either above or below the train tunnels. This creates a number of very odd-shaped cross passages, some of which have stairways. The PA arrangement at these places also becomes non-standard, with additional local microphone units, amps and loudspeakers. In the case of a breakdown or emergency in the running tunnels, train movements in both running tunnels may be stopped, the doors to the cross passages opened, allowing passengers to disembark from the train into the service tunnel. These measure 4.8 metres in diameter, a bit larger than the average London Underground tunnel. Train guards would use the local microphone points in the cross passages to make announcements to passengers. These local mic units, positioned to the rear of the speakers, presented a potential feedback problem, a combination of a sharp Q parametric equaliser and a frequency shifter has been used, allowing the margin to be significantly improved. Whitley commissioned Sandy Brown Associates to handle the acoustic survey. Alex Bird, a consultant with Sandy Brown, comments, "In the service tunnel, we were limited as to where we could hang loudspeakers because of other services. The speakers will be hung along the centre line of the tunnel. The effect will, of course, depend on how many people are in the service tunnel, but even when empty and at its most reverberant, speech will be intelligible." Sandy Brown Associates also tested a number of loudspeakers for use on the project, carrying out tests in both an anechoic chamber and the tunnel itself. DNH speakers were eventually chosen, having been designed to cope with a continuous 90 dBA background noise level. The system amplifiers, 250 in all, 150 in the tunnel, and 100 shared between the terminals, are of Whitley design and manufacture, an enhanced version of the company's SOLAS, sound-operated automatic level adjustment system amplifiers. The tunnel models are called SOALIST, short for sound-operated automatic level and impedance speaker testing adjustment system. Steve Radford, Whitley Engineering Director and Tunnel Project Coordinator, explains, "With this PA system, the highest level of resilience and reliability are required, with the anticipated infrequent usage, along with extensive self-testing and monitoring capabilities. Each amplifier has its own microprocessor, plus a number of inbuilt facilities, including the ability to automatically adjust output according to ambient sound levels by listening through its own loudspeakers. The SOALIST amplifiers also have a testing facility to check impedance in the loudspeakers. They have a 19 kHz tone through loudspeakers at regular intervals, thus detecting broken or shorted cables. Outside the tunnel, in the terminal areas, a different set of problems had to be faced. On the loading platforms, speakers will be suspended from steel hawsers running between posts, thus eliminating the need for columns every few yards. In other parts of the terminal areas, the original plan called for many smaller speakers to be used. This worked out well at the Folkestone terminal, a fairly compact site, lying in close proximity to residential areas, and with all the usual risks of noise annoying the locals. The Coquel terminal, located well away from residential areas and with acreage to spare, has required a different approach. The small speakers have given way to much larger devices for bigger areas. Beyond supplying equipment with the necessary performance and endurance features required, Whitley has had to ensure that the PA system itself would continue working should parts of it be damaged. To this end, equipment throughout the system is connected to fibre optic cables in such a way that only half the loudspeakers in any area would be lost if one of the cables were damaged. The system has been planned so that a sufficient and intelligible level of sound will be supplied with half the speakers functioning. In addition, the microphone units in the tunnel cross passages have a set of duplicate equipment in situ as backup. There is similarly redundancy in IPIS, the central control system. As a piece of equipment, it can easily handle massive volumes of operations, more than meets the needs of the tunnel system. It can be a long-line PA system, a means of gathering alarms, as well as a remote control system for closed-circuit television. It would have also been possible to allow individual zoning selectivity down to each and every amplifier. In the tunnel, IPIS communicates continuously with each of 142 remote systems in the service tunnel and the 15 or so remote subsystems at each terminal. Information appears on the control panels at the rail control centres and road control centres at the Folkestone and Coquel ends. As a further safeguard, each centre has a duplicate set of equipment as backup. Steve Radford explains that the system's key features are its reliability and fault tolerance. IPIS has a polling self-monitoring function to detect faults and will automatically switch to a duplicate set of gear. It takes just seconds for it to check each of the 142 remote systems. Speed was critical, so all data interfaces are to CCITT X21 standards, operating at 64 kilobits per second. Without IPIS, we would have needed 1,000 pair cable throughout the tunnel. For the future operating staff of Eurotunnel, the road control centre will deal with the PA system in the terminal areas, while the rail control centre will control the tunnel PA. Although the two are essentially independent, there are serial data and audio links that allow staff to broadcast to any part of the PA network from each rail terminal. The terminal PA system is broken down into around 50 subzones, so announcements can be made to specific areas, customs control for instance, or to the middle section of a loading platform. We've actually reduced the selectability of the system. It would have been easy to allow staff to address individual loading ramps, but this would have been too much for staff to deal with. Midway through the contract, all appears to be going to plan. It would seem that, at least with the emergency PA system, safety and reliability are primary concerns. How often we get to experience its capabilities depends on just how safe everything is in the tunnel. The concrete lining, the possibility of earth tremors, fire hazards, and the potential of terrorist attacks. Although it's something of a somber note to finish on, if something really catastrophic happens down there, the public address system will merely be an academic consideration. All About the Channel Tunnel there by Kathleen White in Sound and Communication Systems.
Designers can work in virtual reality. NEC Corporation has unveiled an experimental virtual reality system that allows several designers to work together over a network in a three-dimensional environment. Users wear gloves and 3D glasses to interact in the network, but the response speed remains less than real time. Each movement of the hand requires numerous calculations, so imagine what happens when you have a bunch of people working and sending massive amounts of data over a network, an NEC spokesman said. The NEC approach includes three virtual reality techniques: a plain cursor method for speedy object cutting operations, approximation by polyhedron method for separation and recomposition of objects, and a shape data exchange protocol to minimize the data transmitted over the network. The system is still in the development stage, but NEC plans to introduce a software product for low-end workstations in 2 or 3 years, the spokesman said. That from Electronics World News. A letter from Frank Parisot from Bagneux in France. He's listening on 3910. 2 kilometres from Paris is where he is. Yes, the name's familiar now I think of it. I'm an old listener of your nice radio on 6205. That's kind of you. Since the beginning of May 1991. Congratulations for the music. And a souvenir from Paris to Radio Facts. A nice postcard. Thanks very much to everyone who sends postcards. It's much appreciated. And he's got some photos of himself as well on his photocopied sheet. Thanks very much. That's Frank Parisot, just outside Paris.
Tonight, I found it hard to say. She thought I'd had enough of her. Why can't she see? She's lovely to me, but I like to stay here and watch TV on my own. My girl's mad at me. Been on the telephone for an hour. We hardly said a word. I tried and tried, but I could not be heard. Why can't I explain? Why do I feel this pain? 'Cause everything I say, she doesn't understand. She doesn't realize. She takes
to our look at the potential demise of the LP record.
Turn your old 78s into today's CDs, Dan Houston explains in The Independent. The first CD recordable machines have arrived in Britain. For all practical purposes, these behave the same way as a conventional cassette recorder, except the system is digital and uses blank CDs rather than tape. It is now possible for consumers to make digital copies of compact discs and to record their existing LP collections, tapes, home video, soundtracks, and even themselves via microphone onto CD. All of the Silver Disc's benefits, from its sound quality and durability as a non-contact playback medium, to its portability in the car system or CD Personal, apply to recordable CDs. Like most new technologies, recordable CD players and blank discs will be expensive. The first machine from Micromega of Paris retails in Britain for £4,500, while the Japanese-made blank discs cost just under £13. Clearly, only the most zealous and deep-pocketed audiophiles will invest, but the system has much wider applications that will interest the general music lover. These machines will make it easy for record and hi-fi shops to offer a CD recording service, converting treasured and otherwise unavailable LPs, or making up favourite musical compilations for customers. Even those stacks of old 78s made obsolete by the 33rpm LP in the 50s can be brought down from the attic and metamorphosed to digital. Using a high-quality turntable and properly cleaned vinyl as the source, recordable CD delivers excellent results. To most people, the discs will sound quieter and clearer than the original LP. The best record players confidently track warped, dusty, and even scratched records. The new CD recorders can make unlimited copies of discs. However, to safeguard against copyright piracy, the discs are encoded so that they cannot be digitally copied themselves. Recordable CD, or CDR as it is known in hi-fi circles, has been available to the record and broadcast industries for a couple of years. It is replacing limited pressing runs, promotional material on tape, and syndicated interviews. So far, it has been prohibitively expensive, with discs costing about £100 each. The new generation of recorders are all made in Belgium by Philips, which is licensing the system to several companies, with Micromega in the vanguard. Philips's own players will arrive in the autumn at an anticipated cost of £1,500. CD recorders use two lasers. One is for playback, while the second is stronger to record, or literally burn in, the microscopic pits on the blank disc's surface. Once recorded, the gold-coloured disc cannot be erased, but it is compatible with any CD player. Purely digital recordings can be made by linking the CDR machine directly to a CD player. These are theoretically perfect copies, and there are even some reports suggesting they offer better sound quality than the original compact discs. Its proponents argue that CDR effectively rewrites a CD, itself a mass-produced copy, rather than trying to reproduce it like a mirror image. If so, recordable CDs will be seen to have higher fidelity characteristics than the normal discs. This is commensurate with music cassettes, where pre-recorded examples are generally considered inferior to blank tape. The price of recordable CDs will fall as the technology is embraced by the consumer. The wildly enthusiastic are claiming that player recorders will cost only 20% more than normal CD players, and that discs will retail for less than £5 within a few years. Although CD has already proved that it can live the solitary life as a high-quality music source with its own recording capability, it will have to fight for its place against other digital recording systems. The strongest of these is Digital Compact Cassette, DCC, another Philips invention, which the Dutch company is jointly launching with Panasonic this summer. The record industry, led by PolyGram, sees DCC as the next success story after compact disc, and plans to sell pre-recorded tapes for about £14, the same as premium price CDs. Customer reaction at the local record shop was predictable. "That much for tape? They must be joking. You can buy a CD for that." Dan Houston on CD Machines That Record in The Independent.
You're listening to Sparks every week on Radio Fax 6205, 12255 and 3910. From Perthshire in Scotland, Dunblane to be exact, Graham Stevenson writes, Just a quick note to let you how much I enjoy your programmes, particularly Sparks, Archive Feature and Classic Gold. 6205 is always perfect here in central Scotland. 3910 is also fairly good, but 12255 is a complete blank. By the way, whatever became of Chrissy? Well, she's now working for Gem AM, an AM gold station in Nottingham, Derby and Leicester. Anyway, I really enjoyed the old RNI recordings last Friday and have added them to my own collection. Like yourselves, I also have a lot of old offshore tapes in my archive, but I also collect old BBC comedy shows and old Second World War broadcasts. I have many news broadcasts from 1940 onwards, and also a good selection of recordings put out by the Nazi propaganda station in Berlin throughout the war. I'm trying to track down any recordings that may survive of broadcasts from the stations in the German-occupied countries, especially Holland, Belgium, Norway and Denmark, and was wondering if you can read this letter on air, and could any RadioFacts listeners help in this matter? If anyone has any tapes of those old broadcasts, I'd be very interested to hear from them, with a view to an exchange of material. Best wishes for 92. Well, I personally would like to hear some of these recordings. I'll have to try and arrange perhaps a programme of 1940s material of some sort. That would interest me. Anyway, Graham Stevenson writes from Perthshire in Scotland.
You've heard about disc jockeys, but have you heard about hold jockeys on the telephone?
A purpose-built studio there in Weybridge. That's Tell right. us a bit about that.
Well, it's just like any normal radio studio. We've got a proper 12-track mixer, a Denon dual CD system, and something like 150 compact discs to choose from.
So all the gear?
Oh, everything's here.
So how does it feel actually broadcasting, though, only to people on the other end of a phone? Is it different to doing the work you were doing before?
Well, before I used to do nightclubs and things like that, and broadcasting to an audience, you can see the response straight away. You get a real charge out of it. Whereas here, all you can see is a brick wall in front of you, and you just have to trust that there are people on the other end of the line listening and that they are enjoying what you're saying to them.
Well, let's hope they are. Certainly it's better than that wretched computer music you get played, I'll tell you that from experience. You say you went off to the States. What sort of things did you see there? Presumably they're pioneering this, are they?
They started this project about 2 years ago. Originally the idea was the queues into their customer support were getting so long. They developed a telephone system whereby the hold jockey was just a supervisor who would watch a computer monitor and then pluck people who'd had long wait times out of support groups and replace them in support groups that have available operators.
Oh, I see, so sort of moving them around so they didn't have to wait too long.
Yeah, it would have taken them so long to develop an artificially intelligent system to do this that they thought, well, let's put some real intelligence on the end of it.
Oh, it's nice to know that human beings aren't completely overridden these days.
That's right, and then from there they said, well, while they're rerouting these people, let's get them to play some music down the phone to them and try and make their wait time go a little bit easier.
Well, it sounds like a brilliant idea. I know that you give sort of technical tips about the company's products as well as software and so on, but you also give traffic reports, not actually road traffic reports, but traffic reports about the lengths of the queues.
Yeah, the traffic news from the telephone queues.
So does that, from your experience, does it sort of ease people's frustrations when they're waiting?
That's right. I've got a couple of screens, so I know what the queue lengths are into certain groups, and I can say if you've phoned in for PC support, there are five other people waiting with you. The longest person has waited there for, say, 3 minutes. So if you've been there for 3 minutes, you'll know you're next in line to be answered, and the next available operator is answering you.
Well, it's a brilliant idea. I know you enjoy your work. You're a bit of a threat to me, so perhaps we'll do a swap one day, David. You can come and work here for a day and I'll come up there.
Yeah, I'd enjoy that.
Okay, many thanks for joining us on the programme this afternoon.
All right, thanks very much.
Cheers.
Thank you, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's David Wright. He's hold jockey, and the chances are you'll hear him at work if you ring WordPerfect UK, the software manufacturers, based in Weybridge.
That was Steve Watts there on BBC Radio Surrey, all about hold jocks. Sounds like job opportunities for displaced ILR presenters, as the local stations gradually amalgamate into semi-national networks and sack their local staff. We'll be right back.
columnist in IEE News, who goes under the rather strange name of Dipole, was not really a member of the Ovaltinis, but used to listen into their spot on Radio Luxembourg on Sunday evenings in the 1930s. It is certain that many readers did the same, and they, with Dipole, will share the regret of Stephen Williams, now aged 84, but who in the old days was what is now called a presenter, that the transmission must turn skywards from 1992 and will only serve those with satellite dishes and stereo television. The media have waxed nostalgic over the way this early commercial radio station wove its programmes and sponsors into the fabric of the nation. The United Kingdom. Friday night, for many, will always be Armami night, whether it is See You Saturday or not. The InfraDraw pool system may have made fortunes for a few punters, but it taught many more how to spell Keensham. There was a lot of hair about in post-war Britain, and Stablond and Brunitex shampoos were viable preludes to the Armami set. Lord Haw-Haw used the Radio Luxembourg transmitter during the Second World War without the approval of the founders. Pre-war Britain had responded well to the appeal of the station when it began transmitting in 1933. The intention was to provide something lighter than the BBC's light programme. To its credit, Radio Luxembourg did this without sinking into the gutter, and was rewarded with weekend audiences bigger than those claimed by the BBC. Dipole recalls that there was always a certain amount of fading, so presumably an unintentional skyward transmission was ever present. Now the station, fading for the last time from the radio wave bands, will be remembered by many as they take their late-night milk and malt. Or were you, like Dipole, usually enjoying a rival brew as the sweet little voices warbled their good nights? Yes, and I'm thinking of joining the IEE? Well, perhaps not.